guard led the three people through an open gate and into the courtyard of a small, walled estate. The lawn was richly grassed and full of decorative, aromatic flowering plants. The house was significantly larger than most of those they had seen on their way through the city. As soon as Descartes walked through the door of the house, he began to open the seals of his armor.
It's been a long time since I've worn this thing. I've forgotten how heavy all this shit can be.
Grant, Defore, and Kane followed the young man into a large open room, circular in shape, almost like a pavilion. A single, low wooden table rested in the center of the floor, surrounded by six very large overstuffed pillows. The windows were covered by curtains made of strung-together beads, intertwined with strips of dyed gauze. Oil lamps burned on small pedestals, shedding a flickering yet strangely comforting illumination on the surrounding tapestries and murals. A young woman hustled from an adjacent room, her slender body draped in the flimsiest of coverings. Her heavy black hair rested on her shoulders, and her breasts swayed beneath the thin material. In one hand, she carried a tray laden with sliced fruit and chunks of well-cooked meat. With her other hand, she carefully balanced a tray containing four large clay mugs. She placed both trays on the table and stood by as Descartes handed her pieces of his armor.
Help yourself to the food.
None of the three people made a move toward it.
If I wanted to kill you, I wouldn't poison you.
What about drugging us?
Descartes grimaced in exasperation, then took a piece of meat from the tray and bit into it.
You're in my house. You're my guest, so I won't be poisoning you or drugging you.
How many people live here with you?
My wife, Mavati, her maid, Kirhet here, and Cassie.
Defore picked up a mug and sniffed its pale amber contents tentatively.
Smells like beer. Not bad. Who's Cassie? Your child?
Adopted child, I guess you could say. Without her, I wouldn't have met Mavati or still be alive, for that matter.
Where is she now?
Divination school, in training to be an oracle. She's naturally gifted.
Divination school?
Kane reached down and picked up a pair of mugs. He handed one to Grant.
In training to be an oracle. Just an ordinary family.
They clinked mugs. Descartes' eyes darted first to Kane, then to Grant.
I know this has been a lot to lay on you, but...
That's where you're wrong. You haven't laid nearly enough on us. That's the problem.
Descartes unzipped the one-piece Kevlar weave undergarment and peeled it off, apparently completely comfortable being nude in front of his guests. Kirhet took the coverall and handed him a loosely woven cotton robe.
I'm trying to earn your trust. You've been allowed to keep your weapons.
So has Erica Van Sloan and her Imperial goons. We're still outgunned.
No one will harm you here. As guests of Aten, your safety and well-being are guaranteed by the Queen herself.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better. You still haven't told us how and why we were expected here.
The card gestured to the cushions around the table.
Sit and eat. In a little while, I'll do my best to explain.
The three people exchanged uneasy, questioning glances, then sank down on the pillows. Kirhet carried away Descartes' armor. Kane took a healthy swig of the liquid in the mug, and then gasped for breath as it scorched a path down his throat and into his stomach.
What in the hell is this?
It's called Hennekit. It's the local brew. It's pretty strong, but you get used to it after a while.
Reba, you might have told me it was so strong.
Kane, you might have taken a little sip to test it first.
Grant took an experimental swallow and repressed a shudder.
It packs quite a punch for beer.
Descartes selected a piece of fruit from the tray and bit into it.
As I said, you get used to it.
You seem to have gotten used to a lot of things in a short time.
What do you mean?
I mean, you're Vil born and raised and trained to be a mag. Yet you fit right into this place, and something about that just doesn't feel right to me.
And why is that, Kane? Because people are happy and well-fed? Because there are no Tartarus pits, no high towers, no shortages of goods, no slavery?
There's that, and the fact that a settlement this size has remained hidden for so long.
Kirhet reappeared, placing a pitcher of Hennekit on the table. As she did so, she whispered a few words into Descartes' ear, and he nodded in satisfaction. She then left the room.
No slavery, eh?
Descartes' boyish features colored slightly from embarrassment.
She came with the house, actually.
So, things aren't quite so different here than the Vills.
No. You're wrong there. See, even though Otten has its ruling class and working class, servants and nobles, people are treated with respect and equality, no matter what their position is.
So why do I doubt you?
I don't know. Probably because you're a cynic. The reason that everyone is treated with equal respect in Otten is because it's drilled into them from the moment they're born that they have a responsibility to the community. All the citizens have roles to play. The nobles make the laws, settle disputes, and provide jobs. The working class builds the homes. They grow and harvest the crops, teach the young, make the food, and attend to the needs of everyone. No one here is without a job, unless they're too old or infirm to work. Kerhet is a perfect example of that. She's of noble birth, and as such, she's one of the reasons Otten has never been discovered.
Grant popped a piece of fruit into his mouth.
Explain.
Descartes smiled slightly.
All of the nobles in Otten are Sais.
Sais? As in Sai Muties? The whole city of them?
No. Only the noble class. Queen Nephron could explain it a lot better than I could, but from what Mavadi has told me, during the first couple of years of unification, when the baronies were just being established, Muties all across the Outlands were being hunted down and exterminated. That included a lot of Doomies, telepaths, and other Sai Muties. I guess somehow they were all attracted to Otten. And the ones who actually made it here were offered sanctuary.
The image of Baron Sharp's Doomseer advisor, Crawler, came to Kane's mind. He wondered if there was any chance that the mutant might know of Otten. And then he dismissed the thought. If that were the case, Sharp's troops would have invaded long before.
So because of all the Sai Muties that came here, they were able to keep the city totally isolated and hidden from view?
That pretty much sums it up. The way I understand it, anyone who came into the city's territory was offered a chance to become a citizen, where they had their memories altered and were sent on their way. Over the past 80 years, Nephron's people had encountered a few magistrates and implanted memories of nothing but barren wastes around here. There probably hasn't been a mag patrol out this way in 30 years or more.
I still don't get it, though. If Kerhet is a noble, why is she serving us? Wouldn't you have other workers doing that?
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? She actually chose the role for herself. She's not only a servant, but she's a loyal advisor to my wife and her best friend from childhood.
You move fast, don't you?
What do you mean?
You've only been in the city for, what, about a year now? And you've married the daughter of the Queen, and apparently you give orders to her sectmen, the Incarnates. Pretty nice setup.
I don't have any kind of setup going here. Just so happens that Mavadi nursed me back to health after I was found out in the desert. Things just kind of clicked between us.
Kane found what he was looking for with his questioning. The young expatriate was clearly loyal to the Queen and to the city, and not running a scam.
How did she find you out in the desert?
It's sort of a complicated story. She wasn't looking for me.
So then who was she looking for?
I wanted to wait until your friends got here so I don't have to tell it more than once. They're a little late.
The oracles again?
Exactly. I thought they'd be here by now. Kerhet told me she had been told they were on their way, but the oracles aren't always precise when the measurement of time is a factor.
If your oracles were so positive our friends would follow us, why couldn't we have just waited for them at the redoubt?
The way it's been explained to me is that until an action is taken by the subjects of divination, only generalized guesses can be made. So apparently your friends found out fairly quickly something was wrong and used the redoubt's gateway to come help.
I find that a little hard to believe.
You say they're in here?
If this is a trap!
I assure you, there is no trap.
Descartes looked at Grant.
Hard to believe, you say?
The three Outlanders hastily rose to their feet. Mavadi swept regally through the doorway, followed by Brigid Baptiste, Domi, and Lakesh. All of them looked perplexed and more than a little irritated, even though Brigid had perfected a poker face during her years as an archivist. She wore a form-fitting shadow suit, while both Lakesh and Domi were rigged out in camos and ill-fitting flak jackets. Domi spoke first.
Figured you needed some help. Got another shitty one percenter again?
Kane tilted his head toward the viand-laden table and grinned.
Doesn't it look like it?
There's probably nothing more irritating on Earth than rushing to the rescue of endangered friends, only to find them breaking bread with their supposed captors.
They're not prisoners. Neither are you, as I explained.
Grant noticed the three new arrivals were still armed.
No trouble, I take it?
None to speak of, though we had a couple of bad minutes there after we opened the redoubt door and found a man with a jackal's head waiting for us.
Nearly shot him before he could tell us what was up.
Kane saw the frown crossing Mavati's face, so he quickly made introductions all around. Descartes nodded to the three people in turn.
I'm very pleased to meet you all.
Why?
I've been asking him that myself, but he's been evasive. I can tell you it has something to do with the presence of Erica Van Sloan.
The reaction among the new arrivals was mixed. Bridget only blinked. Domi's upper lip curled over her teeth in a half-snarl, and Lakesh's hand rose reflectively to touch the gray-threaded hair at his temples. Domi reverted to the clipped mode of Outland speech under sudden stress.
What's that bitch doing here?
Descartes gestured to the table and the cushions.
I was only waiting for everybody to arrive so I could explain. There's a lot going on here that could affect the Berenice, for both good and bad. It's pretty obvious the Van Sloan woman and this imperator of hers are aware of it. If you'll take seats, please, Mavati and I will make you aware of it, too.
The tale related by Descartes, with occasional interjections and clarifications by Mavati, was not as strange as some the Cerberus warriors had heard, but it was strange enough to rivet even Domi, whose attention span was notoriously limited. The young man told the Outlanders what he had learned of Mission Invictus, the redoubt in the desert, and the project to create the perfect human specimen to thrive in a post-nuke environment. They had succeeded, creating two life forms, a male and a female. The male was named Alpha, the female Epsilon. Due to a side effect of the genetic recombination technique, there was a pigment change in their eyes, which turned them bright red. The test subjects matured at an accelerated rate, but Epsilon died mysteriously. Alpha entered suspended animation for nearly a century. Upon reviving, he took the name Akhenaten and set about establishing the Kingdom of Aten with the mind-controlled aid of a band of farers who had arrived at the redoubt in order to loot it. He dominated them totally and took a farer woman to wife, who bore him Nephron. A few years later, the woman died. Nephron blamed her father. 16 years later, a group of wanderers arrived at the redoubt. Lured to Aten, they were ambushed and promptly captured. A woman with psionic abilities was among the group. She was chosen to become the bride of Akhenaten and the mother to a new race. Over the years, Akhenaten had developed a method of casting and molding through the application of natural softening and hardening agents. By utilizing it, he had expanded the city of Aten and had seen to the construction of a pyramid. He believed that once the capstone, made of minerals with powerful piezoelectric properties, was put into place, his psionic abilities would become godlike. The teenaged Nephron feared her father's ambition as much as she admired his other accomplishments. She wove a complicated web of plots, counterplots, and deceptions that ended when the Outlander woman Akhenaten had chosen as a bride killed him. Nephron claimed the title of queen, and the people of Aten accepted her unquestioningly. Over the following decade, she exerted a firm but just rule. She provided a high standard of living for her people. But even isolated as they were in the Barrens, Nephron was not completely ignorant of the events swirling in the outside world. When rumors of the program of unification reached her as fact, not unsubstantiated fears, she realized Aten was far too exposed and would eventually be discovered by baronial expeditionary forces. The queen ordered the entire city dismantled. What could not be transported was buried in the shifting sea of sand. Nephron had secretly built a mechanism into one of the pyramid's chambers that would cause it to collapse when triggered. The rest of the city, including its inhabitants, relocated to a canyon discovered some years before by the queen's father. There, using the stone molding technique he had perfected, the entire city of Aten was rebuilt, including the Black Sphinx meant to symbolize the dual nature of Akhenaten. Within it was stored all the scientific and medical equipment from the Mission Invictus redoubt, including the secrets of selective mutation, secrets that Nephron began using to improve the health of the citizenry and to ensure their safety. Although Akhenaten's superhuman mental abilities were not something she had inherited, she set about making minute alterations in the genetic structure of Aten's nobility.
Your queen created muties on purpose as Aten's ruling class?
Helpful or harmful mutations often depend solely on the environment in which an organism lives. Here, the mutations were helpful.
And what about the creatures who came out of the redoubt? Helpful or harmful?
Brigid reached for a slice of fruit.
What creatures?
Tersely, he told her about the cat and hawk-headed entities, and how their retreat back into the installation had resulted in the malfunctioning door. During the story, Kane noticed how Descartes shifted uncomfortably on the cushions.
He called them a Harusian and a Bastion.
Ah, yes. Obviously referencing Horus, the hawk-headed god, and Bast, the cat goddess. More of Nephron's mutations, I take it.
Not exactly. More like Akhenaten's.
Brigid fixed a penetrating stare on the young man's face.
Explain.
I don't know if I can.
No need, dear. I will explain. A century ago, Akhenaten determined to create an army to protect Aten.
I got the impression that's what the Incarnates were supposed to be.
My grandfather used them as a template. Only in this instance, he intended to cast them in the mold of the ancient Egyptian pantheon of gods, the Akaku. He created only a handful of them through genetic manipulation, speeding up their adaptations by some method I do not understand. My mother suspects the technique was actually ancient, perhaps of extraterrestrial origin, since Akhenaten created the pantheon in a vault hidden beneath the Sphinx in Giza.
Lakish and Brigid exchanged quick, knowing glances.
Akhenaten apparently was not pleased with the final result and had the Akaku placed in cryostasis. When my mother learned of their existence, she used the gateway to travel to the vault, and she freed them. She offered them full citizenship in Aten. At first, they accepted, but then they turned against her.
Why?
The Queen should be the one to reveal that to you. If she deems it part of the negotiations, she will tell you.
Just what are we negotiating for?
I thought you had realized by now that the Imperator wishes to take possession of all the secrets of my grandfather's creation.
We're not interested in a selective mutation process. Our need is for specialized medical equipment.
Nevertheless, you cannot have what you need to help Quivel and her unborn child without access to the Mission Invictus technology and methodology. If Van Sloan is favored by my mother, then she will walk away with it all. You will then have to negotiate with her and her son, Sam.
That won't happen. Isn't there a council of nobles or elders we can appeal to? A king, maybe? Who's your father?
A faint smile touched Mavati's full lips, but she didn't reply.
I think if we ran a genetic test on both Nephron and Mavati, we'd find out they have completely identical DNA.
Kane's eyes widened.
You're a clone of Nephron, not her offspring.
Kane stared at the girl, the meaning of the strong resemblance between Mavati and the Queen rushing over him like cold water.
You're a copy of the Queen?
She was cloned from Nephron's cells and raised as her daughter. That doesn't make her a counterfeit.
We know that, young man. I'm sure friend Kane was just surprised by the revelation.
Surprise is one way of putting it. Being fed up with all the mysteries in this place would be more accurate.
Mysteries?
Like why we're here in the first place.
We've been over that, Kane.
Only through inference. What's all this stuff about oracles foreseeing our arrival here, like we're fulfilling a prophecy or something?
In a way, you are. The oracles have foreseen that we of Aten cannot remain apart and isolated much longer from the outside world. Every day, events bring us closer to discovery. You and Van Sloan represent two different paths Aten may walk.
How did Erica find you?
The one she calls Sam mind-touched the oracles. It is part of the duties of the oracles to cast about telepathically for those who share similar gifts. It is how my husband and the child Cassie came among us.
Sam probably made contact through the heart of the world.
I believe that was the means of initial communication, yes.
From his stronghold in Shan, China, Sam could manipulate the convergence of electromagnetic energies he called the heart of the world. The heart existed slightly out of phase with the third dimension, slightly beyond the human concept of space-time. From its central core extended a web of electromagnetic and geophysical energy that covered the entire planet. He was able to tap into it at will. Grant grimaced in angry impatience.
So these oracles of yours knew we'd be arriving?
Yeah. Van Sloan made them aware of all of you when she consented to have her mind scanned.
And Queen Nephron ordered you to make sure that once we got here, we couldn't leave.
Yes. Like you already figured out, I rigged the door.
And you knew about the Harujan and Bastions showing up?
No. If the Oracles knew about the Akaku gating in, they didn't tell me. I don't think they foresaw it. They're not infallible.
The Akaku have been infiltrating Aten through the gateway for many months. Then why haven't you closed the transit line?
Mavati smiled at her almost pityingly.
If we had, then none of you would have been able to get here.
The Outlanders stared at her for several seconds, surprised into speechlessness.
Flawlessly logical.
I am honored, thank you.
Mavati arose from the table, extending a hand to Descartes.
Come, husband. We have revealed enough to our guests for the evening.
Not nearly enough.
Grant rose, also in a show of courtesy. His companions followed suit.
Perhaps that is so. But whatever else you learn must be from Queen Nephron. She awaits you in the audience chamber tomorrow morning.
When you're ready to sleep, you'll find plenty of bedrooms off this one. We'll talk more after you've had the chance to rest.
Count on it.
The card's eyes flashed, either in apprehension or anger, but he didn't reply. Hand in hand, he and Mavati strolled out of the room through the arched doorway. The six people resettled themselves around the table. Domi propped her elbows on the top of it, resting her chin on her fists.
Got a bad feeling about this place, girls.
Join the club. And one reason why I have such a bad feeling is that Nephron now has the entire command staff of Cerberus in her hands. She can either let us go or turn us over to Erica and Sam.
Do I detect a rebuke?
You've got to admit it was tactically unwise to come after us through the gateway.
The interphaser isn't finished yet, and if we came in the Mantas, we might not have been able to locate the city.
Brigid referred to the transatmospheric craft found on the Manetius base and brought down to Cerberus. Powered by two different kinds of engines, a ramjet and solid-fuel pulse detonation air spikes, the Mantis ships could fly in both a vacuum and in an atmosphere. The transatmospheric planes were not experimental craft, but examples of a technology that was mastered by a race when humanity still climbed trees to escape from saber-toothed tigers.
We've found the situation very strange. We felt it best to investigate now, rather than take the chance of mourning your losses later.
I see your point. Well, we're swimming around in the stew now, so it's best to find out about all the other ingredients.
Brigid shook her head in exasperation at Kane's awful metaphor.
It's apparent to me that this entire negotiation situation is something of a stalling maneuver, if not a dodge altogether.
What do you mean?
I mean, it's possible that Nephron has no intention of making a bargain of any kind with Sam, but she can't flat out refuse him without risking open hostility. He has the means to make it very unpleasant for her and her people.
True. There is far more going on here in Aten than what we've been allowed to see so far. From what I've heard so far, Nephron seems much different from the schemer she was characterized as in historical documents.
Maybe she's not the same Nephron. How could she be and still look so young?
With access to the genetic manipulation technology of Mission Invictus, it would be a greater mystery if she didn't look young.
How so?
Nephron could be employing a youth prolongation system that involves synthesizing telomeres.
Tele-what?
DeFore patiently explained.
Telomeres are sections of DNA that cap chromosomes. They keep them intact, except during cell division. There are some types of enzymes that work as a telomere repair system, even when a cell divides.
So?
So, cells that don't lose telomeres are virtually immortal. Capable of dividing indefinitely and remaining intact.
Lakesh tugged absently at his long nose.
Very interesting and very possible, all things considered. If such a mechanism is here in Aten, then by monopolizing it, Sam would have yet another fulcrum by which to force cooperation among the Barons.
Exactly. But this is all speculation. Until Mavati or even Erica decides to come clean with us, we're going to have to wait until our audience with the Queen.
Kane consulted his wrist chron, turning the LCD face toward the flickering lamplight.
It can't happen soon enough for me.
Later, Descartes led them down a corridor, wide and high, lighted by flickering tapers and lamps. It seemed to stretch the entire length of the Black Sphinx. A group of robed people waited by an archway and bowed their heads as Lakesh, Descartes, Grant, Brigid, and Kane passed by.
The priesthood of Aten.
What god do they serve?
A composite made up of Ta'a and Tenen, a craft god and a creation god.
Kane did his best to swallow a yawn, but not because he found the young man's explanation boring. None of the outlanders had slept very deeply, despite their host's assurances of safety. All of them had taken shifts standing guard until daybreak. A delicious breakfast served by Kerhet was a small consolation for a fitful night. Dakar joined them for the meal, wearing the traditional linen skirt and gold collar of Egyptian royalty. His wife, Mavati, had already departed to join the queen. He provided them with the bare bones of royal etiquette, which amounted mostly to not speaking unless spoken to. Domi and Reba Defour had chosen to stay behind, just in case a rescue was called for. As they passed the priests, they noticed one robed man standing apart from the others. Clad in a gold skullcap and a tabard of stiff red fabric, he didn't bow to the outlanders. Instead, his brown-eyed gaze was one of suspicion and hostility. His deeply seamed face held no particular expression as he watched the procession approach.
High Priest Opet. He and his sect disagree with the queen about her policy of making contact with the outside. He's a fanatical isolationist.
Opet fell into step behind them. As the group walked through the archway, they passed a pair of incarnates. The two animal-helmeted warriors paid no heed to the four people. They stood as still as granite statues, looking impeccable in their spotless gold-trimmed kilts and ram-headed helmets. The walls and roof of the corridor were covered in brightly colored hieroglyphs. They were rendered with great artistry, and each section of wall seemed to bear a single story. Kane stared at them as they passed, but not in wonder or curiosity. He committed to memory their location using certain illustrations as a reference guide. Chambers opened off the corridor, and what the group of outlanders could see of their interiors gave an impression of an almost sensual luxury, with long, low divans of velvet and the gleam of precious metals and gems. The procession made its way through a column-supported doorway, big and broad, and magnificently carved in high relief were scenes of men and women riding in chariots. The corridor ended abruptly in an enormous cavern, a natural one where rock formations had been formed into fantastic shapes by the passage of eons. Another pair of incarnates stood at attention at the mouth of the cavern, and they stepped aside, allowing the group to stride along a path of marble tiles sunk into the floor. Light was provided by an inestimable number of brass lamps mounted on stone pedestals, made from stalagmites with the tops sheared off flat. The people followed the tiles to the audience chamber of Nefren, daughter of Akhenaten, ruler of Aten. Kane felt a distant quiver of surprise at its austerity. Queen Nefren sat on a throne situated in the hollow center of the chamber. She wore a sheer white gown that left her arms bare. A high-crested white wooden crown with a small golden sun disk above the rim rested atop her head. It completely concealed her glossy black hair. She held the nekek, the royal flail, at a 45-degree angle over her left breast. Many bejeweled rings winked on her long fingers. Mavati, dressed in a similar fashion, stood on her right side. The throne itself was apparently carved, or molded, from the same stone as the cavern, shaped to resemble a sitting man. It was modeled after the statues they had seen of Akhenaten, and so Nefren essentially ruled from the lap of her father. The symbolism was odd, but definitely effective. The throne was elevated about 5 feet above the floor by a miniature pyramid. Erica Van Sloan and her uniformed soldiers stood at the base of the pyramid. The troopers were armed, but so were Kane, Grant, Lakesh, and Brigid. The outlanders had no grounds on which to lodge an objection. As it was, there were at least 20 people in the chamber, from incarnates to skull-capped priests to various officials and functionaries. 6 blue-robed women wearing burnous-like headdresses stood in a little semicircle around the pyramid, their eyes downcast. The atmosphere of the audience chamber felt electrically charged with anticipation. Nefren swept the outlanders with her chilling blood-red gaze.
Brigid Baptiste, Grant, Kane, and Prince Dakar, I bid you welcome. Mohandas Lakesh Singh, Erica Van Sloan, you may come forward.
Lakesh made a pointed effort not to so much as glance in Erica's direction, as he obeyed the queen's bidding. Erica didn't feel so restrained. She followed his progress with a smile of pure malice on her lips.
I am told you have come here searching for a way to help a friend.
That's true, Your Highness. The medical knowledge you have here may save two lives.
So my oracles have said.
Nefren fixed her gaze on Erica.
Tell me again why I should withhold my aid from these people.
Certainly, Your Highness. But I would prefer to speak of these matters with you privately, out of earshot of this man and his companions, who have declared war on my son. Lakesh will spout only lies about the Imperator.
A faint smile creased Nefren's lips. She waved the flail toward the robed women.
They are the diviners, the most adept of Aten's sect of oracles. No lies shall be allowed to be spoken here, neither in public nor in private.
Opet suddenly spoke from behind them in a strident tone full of angry resentment.
They are all strangers in our city, Your Majesty. We should trust one no more than another.
Nefren's eyes flicked toward the priest, then back toward Erica.
I am not fearful of strangers, Opet. Perhaps this Imperator is part of a new force in the world. He may or may not be important to the future of Aten, and that is all I care about. After I have made my decision, we will know who is worthy of our trust and who is not.
The last few words were intended for Erica alone. The tall woman compressed her lips in a tight line as she mouthed an angry protest. She inclined her head and began to speak of Sam the Imperator and the order he sought to bring to the chaos of the outside world. She told the queen of the boons her son had granted the Cerberus warriors, only to have them accept the gifts and spurn the Imperator. They feared and hated him, rejecting his truths in favor of lies about personal freedom. Kane gave the woman credit. She didn't speak complete falsehoods, but she presented Sam's point of view as a well-meaning victim of opportunistic hypocrites. She sounded very earnest, her moral outrage quite convincing. The woman would have continued with her tirade if Nefren had not interrupted.
Let me be clear about what you say. These people prefer chaos and madness to order?
They would not admit so, but they are corrupt, Your Highness.
Erica cast the four outlanders a glare of barely veiled venom. Nefren stared down at Lakesh.
Would you care to dispute these charges?
I do, but there are several things that are disturbing me greatly, things I must make you aware of.
Nefren opened her mouth to respond, but Lakesh held up one hand to stop her.
Please, allow me to speak my own thoughts, rather than hear their interpretations from you or your diviners.
Nefren nodded her head in acknowledgement of his request, clasping her hands before her in a traditional Hindu gesture of respect.
Forgive me, it's a habit.
Thank you, my queen. I am very concerned about the ramifications of your kingdom reaching any kind of accord with Erica Van Sloan. Do you have any idea what sort of creature her Imperator is?
I've told them all they needed to know.
Told them? Due to your formidable telepathic talents, I was certain that you garnered all the information you needed about him from Erica's own mind.
Nefren shook her head and looked directly at Erica, although she addressed Lakesh.
There is something strange about the structure of the Imperial Mother's mind. I can only catch glimpses of her surface thoughts when they dwell on her son. She is, quite honestly, an enigma to me, and that has me more than a little intrigued.
Lakesh recalled what he knew about Erica Van Sloan, and he couldn't think of anything that indicated she was even slightly psionically endowed. Then he realized the telepathic screen was due to the cybernetic implants in her brain, the superconducting quantum interface device, or SQUID. As a brilliant pre-dark cyberneticist, Erica Van Sloan had perfected the squid implant as an interface between mechanical electric and organic. They were only 1/100th of a micron across and drew power from the electromagnetic field generated by the neuronic energy of the brain itself. And now Sam controlled the squid. Lakesh saw Nefren stiffening, and he understood that she was reading his thoughts even as they formed in his mind.
Interesting. Will you allow my diviners to enter your mind and relay your memories among all of us who can share them? Imparting information in this way will be a good deal faster than verbal communication.
Erica took a step toward the throne, her expression registering fear and anger.
Your Highness, I must protest. This man's thoughts regarding my son would be of a highly subjective nature, even his memories.
Silence!
A shiver of fear played up and down Lakesh's spine. He felt certain Nephron could read his thoughts without trouble, and despite his own mental discipline, he was sure that she could bash her way through any barriers he might attempt to erect to keep his private thoughts hidden from her.
Yes, but I ask you one favor.
What is it?
Please, just focus on Sam the Imperator. My personal thoughts should remain just that.
As you wish. To make it easier, simply bring Sam into the forefront of your thoughts. Cassandra, please come forward.
A small robed figure shuffled hesitantly from the group of diviners. She was a child, but her big eyes held a solemn, sad wisdom.
That's Cassie, the kid I told you about.
Search his mind, Cassandra, and share what you find.
Lakesh saw the Queen, Mavati, and all of the diviners bowing their heads and closing their eyes. Shutting his own eyes, Lakesh visualized an image of Sam, as he was when Lakesh last saw him, in the Temple of Shakti in Assam. A young man of medium height, but exceptionally lean of build. He was dressed in an impeccably tailored white linen suit, but he exuded as ominous a flair as if he were dressed in funereal black. His head was long and his face high-planed with prominent cheek and brow bones. The chin was small but sharp. His hair was a lusterless silvery gray and looked very thin, even sparse in some places, but it swept across his high forehead and left temple in a dramatic style. His ears were very small and delicately shaped, nestled close to the skull. A pair of dark, curve-lensed sunglasses masked his eyes. His thin lips were creased in a superior smile. After building Sam's appearance in his mind, Lakesh concentrated on recollections of their prior encounters. He could almost feel the ghostly mental fingers of Cassie creeping along his neural pathways, following the twists and turns as each linked memory touched upon another containing information on the enigma that was Sam the Imperator. Then, as gently as a lover's caress, the insubstantial fingers withdrew from his mind, and he opened his eyes. He saw the diviners still standing motionless with their heads bent. They were completely absorbed in what his mind had revealed. He wondered how long the process had taken. Nephron answered his unspoken question.
Only a matter of a few seconds.
He means us no harm, Your Highness.
Now do you know exactly what Sam has in store for you and the rest of the world?
You lie, Lakesh.
Nephron sat silent for a long time, brooding. Finally, she turned toward Erica Van Sloan.
There is one thing that puzzles me about your son. You are afraid of him and of what he is becoming. You feel a great deal of love as well as fear when you think of Sam. Why is that?
Erica tilted her chin at a defiant angle.
If you know as much as you are claiming, then why are we even bothering to discuss this? You could quite easily choose which side you wish to join and be done with it.
That is true. But the fact that I can't read your intentions as well as I can those of Lakesh makes me less than willing to trust you.
That may be so. Let us assume for the sake of argument that my son is the ruthless conqueror Lakesh and these others make him out to be. By joining us, we will offer Aten untold power in exchange for your loyalties. Aten would be stronger, more powerful than all the baronies combined. And again, if Sam is who Lakesh believes he is, by allying yourself with him, not only would your power spread across this nation, but the rest of the world as well. What do they have to offer?
Freedom. More than these people have ever had in the past. Your Highness, under Sam, you would ultimately answer to him, and the citizens of Aten would be subservient to his every whim.
The Queen's expression remained neutral.
We have all the freedom that we could hope for. We fear no baron, no roamers, no raiders.
You think that you might be enjoying freedom, but consider this. You are still in hiding. Does hiding in a canyon qualify as freedom?
To us, yes. We are waiting until the time is right to join the rest of the world to announce our presence. The arrival of not only Erica Van Sloan, but your people as well, may be a portent. For good or ill, I am not sure.
I would strongly disagree with you on the freedom aspect, Your Majesty. To me, you're nothing more than a bird in a gilded cage, a prisoner in a beautiful home with the illusion of freedom.
I cannot glimpse the future, but my diviners can. Cassandra, What do you see if we strike a bargain with either of the factions represented here?
Cassandra didn't close her eyes this time, but her gaze became distant and vague, fixed on some faraway point. The girl suddenly drew in a sharp breath, then let it out again, blinking repeatedly.
What do you see?
Blood! Much blood will be spilled if we ally ourselves with either the man Lakesh or the woman Van Sloan. Death will come to the holy city of Aten. Death from within, and then from without.
Opet spoke, a hard-edged burst of hatred.
Then all of the outsiders must die.
Lakesh stiffened, casting a surreptitious glance over his shoulder at Cain. He passed the questioning glance on to Bridget and Grant, who nodded almost imperceptibly in response. Cain and Grant began tensing their wrist tendons in preparation for unleathering their sin-eaters. The hall became so still, Cain fancied he could hear every breath that was drawn, every beat of a heart. Cain spun toward the direction of the sound. One of Erica's troopers was bent over almost double, squeezing his helmeted head with both hands. Erica gaped at him, too surprised to speak. The man straightened as suddenly as if he had been jerked erect by an invisible string. He looked around the cavern, his narrowed eyes traveling over the gathered people, pausing only briefly on Grant, Lakesh, and Bridget. Then they froze on Kane's face. The trooper whipped up his SIG AMT, training the barrel on a direct line with Cain. Erica Van Sloan delivered a graceful high kick to the barrel of the subgun, and the stream of slugs went high, bouncing and ricocheting from the roof of the cavern. Cain dodged to the side, moving with a swiftness that surprised even him. Grant and Bridget instinctively lunged away from each other so as not to present conveniently grouped targets. Sin Eaters snapped out of Cain's and Grant's power holsters, slapping firmly into their hands. Both weapons swung toward the Imperial trooper, who stood gaping open-mouthed at his weapon as if he had no idea what it was. Erica snatched it from his hands and tossed it away, her eyes fixed on Cain's face.
No! He's not responsible!
Screams of fear and anger filled the cavern as the people began a panicky run toward the exit. The diviners backed away from the throne, and Dakard bounded forward to snatch Cassandra up in his arms. Lakesh extended a hand toward Nephra.
Your Highness, come down from there! You're not safe!
A quintet of incarnates jogged toward the throne, metal rods held out before them like spears. Cain met Bridget's eye, and she shook her head in confusion, letting him know she had no more idea of what was going on than he did. Cain glimpsed Bridget wincing in reaction to the sound. An incarnate spun on his toes, his upper left shoulder flying away in a gout of blood and mangled tissue. He dropped his metal rod and cut the hand over the ghastly wound as he fell to his knees. The screams of terror increased in number and volume. Cain wheeled in the direction from which the shot had come and froze, momentarily paralyzed by the nightmare face leering at him from around the side of a stalagmite. The face was inhumanly narrow, and the entire head looked very small in proportion to the rest of the body. It was covered by a downy growth of dark feathers. Instead of a nose and mouth, a cruelly hooked bronze-hued beak jutted out. The eyes on either side of it looked like onyx in molten silver and burned as brightly as a falcon's, but with hatred too bright even for the hunting bird. The creature's body was small and slender, muscularly compact. The wings springing from the shoulders were as darkly feathered as the head, but the span was far too short to allow for true flight. The genetic mutation had not given the creature the gift of flight like the Horus Hawk. Instead, it was only a malformed imitation of the magnificent sun god of myth. The Horusian's arms clasped a heavy rifle of the same make as the one recovered out in the desert. The bore centered on Cain, looking like a hollow cyclopean eye. Cain depressed the Sin-Eater's trigger stud, and three rounds tore through the narrow Horus head, blowing the back of its skull out amid a scattering of feathers. Even as it fell, a bellow of outrage filled the cavern. Cain tried to fix the positions of his friends among the milling throng in the cavern. One of the priests blundered into him and went on without pausing. The tumult in the cavern grew louder as those inside fought their way toward the door. Then a great, darkly furred thing with a broad muzzle and very long arms sprang toward the throne, swinging clenched fists at the incarnates who raced to intercept it. One of the blows bowled a lion-helmeted man off his feet. Cain heard bones break. The creature howled, and Cain realized it dimly resembled a baboon, but one the size of a man. Although its body was completely covered by a coat of stiff black hair, it also wore a kilt-like loincloth. Belly slipping sideways, Cain realized that the genetically altered Akaku was loose in the audience chamber. He knew the timing wasn't a coincidence, not with the queen, the priesthood, the outsiders, and the nobility all present in the same place. It was a coup, pure and simple. The baboon creature's black lips writhed back over foam-flecked yellow fangs as the incarnates converged, little flares of light bursting from the V-prongs of their metal rods. Propelled by inhumanly long arms, the creature bounded swiftly away from the incarnates, snatched up one of the lamps from its pedestal, and flung it at its tormentors. Flaming oil splashed, spread, and exploded. Two of the incarnates reeled away, feeding at the skeins of fire that ignited on their kilts. The baboon creature lunged away into a cloud of smoke. The hammering of autofire rose above the shouts and screams. Squinting through the billowing smoke, Kane saw Erica running through the crowd, followed by two of her men. The other two were engaged in a firefight, but against whom he couldn't see. Rigid rushed over to Kane, pushing the running, milling people out of her way. She double-fisted the Ivor Johnson TP-9 auto pistol she favored.
Where's Lakesh?
Kane glanced toward the elevated throne, but didn't see Lakesh or the Queen. He caught a very brief glimpse of Dakar, still holding Cassie, rushing hand in hand with Mavati across the cavern to a shadow-shrouded point. He assumed they knew where they were going. The staccato roar of guns firing on full automatics slapped at their ears again, and a stream of slugs tore long gouges in the surface of the stalagmite.
Who's doing all the shooting?
I don't know, but we need to get the hell out of here and let the incarnates deal with...
A half-dozen black skull-capped men, stripped down to breech clouts with their limbs wrapped in linen bandages, charged out from between a pair of outcroppings. They gripped skeletal-looking SMW M76 subguns, and they fired indiscriminately, short sprays of flame erupting from the slender barrels. The shell casings twinkled in the light provided by the flames and the lamps. Kane wrestled Bridget down as bullets thumped through the air above them. Two of the incarnates spasmed as the round sewed bloody little dots across their broad chests. They fell backward into screaming, tangle-footed sprawls. The baboon creature lifted its voice in a high-pitched shriek of malevolent triumph.
I don't think we can count on them!
Kane didn't bother to respond. From his prone position, he took hasty aim and fired a burst at the four skull-capped men. At the same time, he heard Grant open up with his own Sin Eater. A sleet storm of rounds pounded into one man's shoulders, chest, and neck. He gurgled out a cry of pain and collapsed to the floor. The three survivors opened fire. One of Aten's nobles spun on his toes, the top of his shaved skull floating away in a red mist. Grant returned the fire with his Sin Eater, the 9mm rounds driving through the side of an attacker's head, opening up his cranium like a ripe melon struck with a hammer. More bandaged men with black skull caps came bounding into the cavern. The incarnates and the weapon-wielding men fired wildly, almost blindly, in any direction. Kane and Bridget stayed low, crawling to the cover of a cluster of stalagmites. They prayed Grant was doing the same. The remaining two Imperial troopers raced to join them, but a burst from a subgun punched through the midnight blue helmet of one of the soldiers. He dropped dead without a sound. His companion managed to make it to cover. Across from the position, a pair of black-capped attackers lay down suppressing fire with the subguns. Kane was forced to pull back, but a massed fusillade blew fist-sized chunks of stone out of the stalagmite behind which he and Bridget had crouched. Turning to the right, Kane saw several of the incarnates engaged in hand-to-hand combat with the new assailants. The din from the stuttering subguns was almost deafening, but they could still hear the shouts of pain and curses coming from all around. He didn't see Grant, but he heard the unmistakable cracking reports of the Sin Eater. Kane switched to the other side of the stalagmite. He eased down to one knee and took a deep breath. Then, swiftly, he reached around the column and kept the trigger stud of his Sin Eater depressed, hosing the area down with a steady 9mm spray. He pulled back just as quickly, as several rounds struck his shelter, dangerously close to his hand. He returned to the other side of the column as the skull-capped men concentrated their fire on the side. As he had expected, the two men had exposed themselves to return the fire to keep him pinned down. Kane put a tri-burst into each man, dropping them. Movement attracted his attention. Kane saw Grant executing a run dodge across the cavern. As he watched, he saw an Imperial trooper, the one Erica had disarmed, move into the open and raise his SIG-AMT, training it on Grant. The expression on the man's face was one of torment, as if he were in great pain. The barrel of the weapon quivered as he brought it into line with Grant. Brigid Baptiste didn't hesitate for a second. She squeezed the trigger of her pistol. The weapon thundered, and a single bullet punched the soldier through the upper chest. Grant threw himself against an 8-foot-tall stalagmite, doing his best to mold his big form against the column. Both factions of the combatants abandoned their positions and rushed forward, meeting one another almost in the dead center of the cavern. The field of combat wasn't designed for mutual advantage. There were only winners and losers, the living and the dead. It was the code by which Kane and Grant both lived, how they were trained as magistrates. The subguns chattered, and the Matar rods flared and sizzled. Animal-headed figures fell and writhed around gunshot wounds. Black skull-capped men convulsed, rolling madly across the cavern floor. More incarnates were falling and staying down than the linen-wrapped attackers. Kane realized that the only chance he, Grant, and Bridget had of leaving the chamber alive was to join the melee, take on the enemy, and force them to disengage from the incarnates. It wasn't a prospect he looked forward to, but it was also clear that the black skull-capped attackers were quickly gaining the upper hand over the incarnates. He and his friends had already chosen sides, and he doubted they would be treated as neutrals if the attackers were victorious. Catching Grant's eye, he made hand signals, indicating what he had in mind. The big man scowled, but nodded. Kane started to edge away from the stalagmite, but Bridget grabbed his left forearm.
What are you going to do?
Try to tip the scales a little so we won't end up as either POWs or confirmed kills.
Well, then I'm going with you.
He glanced at her, noting the hard glints of worry in her emerald eyes.
I'd prefer you didn't. Stay out of sight. Be our ace if things start to go sour.
And then what?
I'll leave that to your discretion. But I think I can speak for Grant in this. We very much appreciate a rescue of some kind.
Bridget gazed at him searchingly for a silent second, then nodded.
Understood.
Kane eased out from cover, Grant shadowing his movements. Almost immediately, four of the linen-wrapped figures converged on Grant. Picking himself into a spring, Kane raced to intercept them. He had crossed less than half the distance, a matter of perhaps 10 yards, when a blinding pain shot through his right leg. It didn't seem to be there, and he fell heavily, barely able to catch himself on his elbows. He looked down, too shocked to do otherwise, expecting to see blood flowing from the ragged stump of where his leg had once been attached, but there was no sign of damage anywhere. Just as he laboriously realized he was stunned, a blow connected with his jaw and knocked him onto his back. Starbursts flared behind his eyes. He didn't lose consciousness, but he instantly forgot about the pain in his leg. Another blow struck his sin eater. Dimly, he understood he had been struck, just behind the knee. His mind felt as if it were coated with soggy cotton wadding. Through the blurred haze of his vision, he watched the baboon creature shamble toward him. A heavy wooden bludgeon was gripped in its right fist, and Kane realized it had delivered the blow to his leg. The creature's muzzle wrinkled in a sneer as it raised the club.
Time to die, Outlander.
The baboon creature brought down the club in a whipping arc, the knotty end of it on a direct line with his head.
Kane!
As if someone had removed the cotton that had been clouding Kane's perceptions, his mind cleared. Despite the pain in his leg, he moved with the speed of a striking cobra, rolling to one side as the cudgel smashed into the stone floor. Coming out of the roll, Kane stayed low and depressed the firing stud of his sin eater. Nothing happened, which he had feared. The blow from the club had been delivered with just enough force to knock the firing pin askew. The baboon creature swung his bludgeon again. With his adversary's much longer reach, Kane knew he couldn't backpedal out of range, so he saw only one option. He threw up his right arm to block the blow. The wood connected solidly with the power holster, which cushioned the impact, but pain still streaked up and down his forearm. The impact sent him staggering. Man and baboon creature slowly circled each other. The creature made a few half-hearted feints toward him, narrowly missing Kane with the wooden club. The human eyes in the beast face burned with hatred. With a sinking sensation in the pit of his stomach, Kane realized he couldn't appeal to his human reason, if any remained inside the malformed head. It lashed out again, and Kane slid to the left. His injured leg twinged. The muscles were already stiffening, slowing his reflexes and reaction time. Suddenly, his adversary jerked as if he had heard some strange noise, which, with the near-deafening cacophony of battle, Kane figured was almost impossible. Lowering its club, the creature glanced first to right, then to left, and back at Kane. Its eyes widened in wonder. Its lips peeled back from its teeth in a grin. Then bloody foam surged forth past its fangs. Gurgling, it slowly pitched forward onto its face, the grin still fixed on its muzzle. Kane saw the crimson bubbling up from the wound in the back of his skull. Massaging his throbbing forearm, he saw Bridget step out from cover, hefting her auto pistol, face pale and pinched with fear.
Thanks. That's the kind of ace I like to see played.
But I didn't play it.
Then what?
Cold realization washed over him and made his flesh crawl. He looked wildly around and saw who and what he feared. Erica Van Sloan stood atop a rock about 70 feet away with one of the SIG AMTs on her shoulder. She flashed him a mocking grin and then leaped down out of sight. Kane set his teeth on a groan of frustration.
Ugh, you can bet she'll be calling in that marker as soon as possible.
Kane didn't dispute her. He was too busy watching Grant in the middle of the whirling, eddying mass of skull-capped and animal-headed men. He moved through the combat like a panther, shooting and clubbing with his sin-eater. The attackers began a slow retreat, dropping out of the melee one by one, then in twos. Then, as if obeying a prearranged signal, all of them that were still ambulatory spilled out across the smoky cavern in a run. Only a few of the incarnates were in any condition to pursue, and they declined, letting their enemies withdraw from the field of battle. Calmly, Grant picked off a pair of the black-capped men, dropping them with a single shot apiece to their backs. The cavern fell silent, broken only by the moans of pain from the wounded and the heavy breathing of the combatants.
We've got to find Lakesh.
He's fine, never fear, as is the Queen.
What the fuck just happened? Who were those sons of bitches?
It appears that the coup we've been fearing has finally started.
Grant stalked over to them.
Mavati, where the fuck did you and Dakar disappear to? We could have used some more help out there.
Her eyes turned cold and she stared defiantly up into Grant's face.
My mother's safety is paramount to us. We went with her and your friend Lakesh to protect her, just in case you and the other defenders couldn't fight off the attackers.
Ugh. Why is it that whenever we show up somewhere, a revolution begins?
After leaving the Sphinx, they were forced to shoulder their way through a large crowd of citizens who were being held back by a group of armed incarnates. The shouted demands for information were almost deafening. Not since the overthrow of Nefren's father, more than a century before, had such violence touched the city-state of Aten.
Where is Erica? It was one of her men who started this, after all.
Mavati slowed her pace so she could walk beside Kane.
I'm sure the Queen knows where to find her. Besides, her soldier was not acting of his own free will.
How can you be so sure of that?
Come on, Kane. You should have figured that out by now.
Oh, yeah? Enlighten us.
His mind was controlled. You already know that many of the citizens of Aten possess psionic abilities to one degree or another. There were a number of nobles in the audience chamber today.
So any one of them could have been responsible?
Theoretically, yes, but there are many possibilities.
And Erica could be part of them. She's smart and she's Sam's puppet. The bitch could have easily staged the whole thing in order to take out your queen.
Do you actually believe that's likely?
We're in a city filled with Psi-muties. My definition of what's likely and what isn't has changed a little bit.
It was clear his words disturbed the young woman, but she composed herself.
My mother will get to the bottom of it soon enough. There is no way that Erica could hide such blatant treachery from her or from Cassie. The truth will come out one way or another.
Where is your mother? Where are you taking us?
I believe you would call it a safe house.
They continued walking through a residential neighborhood and reached a plain single-story building. There were the usual flower beds present, and a pair of small palm trees stood like sentries on either side of the doorway. Mavati pushed open the wooden door and motioned for her three companions to enter. To their mild surprise, they found themselves in a spartanly furnished sitting room. Nefren and Lakesh were present. She sat in a simple wooden chair while he paced anxiously to and fro before her. When the four people came in, his face lit up with relief. Erica Van Sloan stood there as well, arms folded, her eyebrow crooked at a challenging angle when she caught sight of Kane. He met her stare, silently daring her to claim she had saved his life.
I'm delighted to see you all. Even though Her Highness kept assuring me you were all right, I was still worried.
You do that too often. It will age you before your time. I should know.
The informal banter between the two people made Kane feel slightly uncomfortable for a reason he couldn't quite identify.
It seems that our arrival triggered Cassie's portent.
The insurrectionists.
Kane nodded grimly.
The Queen has told me that my man was under some form of telepathic control. Sam won't be happy when he hears he's lost a man, but I'm sure he'll understand you had no choice.
You have no idea how happy I am to hear that. I'm positive he'll bawl his eyes out when he hears that one of his one-size-fits-all drones was killed.
How little you understand him. She has just demonstrated what I have been talking about. Your Highness...
Enough. There are other matters concerning us this day. We've known that an uprising like this was in the making for a very long time.
You knew? Then why didn't you do something about it beforehand?
You're a very intelligent man. You tell me why.
Her straightforwardness took him back a bit. Blinking, he exchanged swift glances with Bridget, Grant, and Kane.
Like you, the insurrectionists have people who can mask or hide their thoughts and plans from your oracles. Perhaps they even have allies among your oracles.
Exactly.
What do these insurrectionists want?
What do insurrectionists always want? A change in the status quo, where their wants take precedent over anyone else's needs.
Whatever their demands, they're apparently in league with the Akaku mutants.
Actually, it's more the other way around. The Akaku enlisted support from a small handful of dissidents here in Aten. Why?
For a long, stretched-out tick of time, Nefron and Mavati exchanged searching glances.
The Amkihyu.
Amikyu?
Essentially, it's a word describing the souls of the blessed who have been fortunate enough to obtain admission into the boat of the sun god Ra as he crosses the night heavens. It's the belief in a form of ascension to a higher plane of existence.
What's that got to do with a bunch of muties?
Aten has many things it wishes to forget about in its history. The Akaku and their belief that they will ascend to a state matching those of the actual gods is one of them.
When my father created them, he was not at all pleased with the final result. He considered them failures, monstrosities. But he didn't express his disgust to them. Quite the opposite, in fact. Due to his advanced powers of mental manipulation, he convinced them they were avatars of his new order, the first generation of godlings, and he was their deity. Their Ra, so to speak.
Lakesh regarded the two women gravely.
I think I can guess the rest. They willingly entered stasis, fully believing your father would resurrect them when the time for gods and goddesses had come around again. The Akaku were less than thrilled when you did the actual reviving instead of your father. I imagine they were downright upset when you finally informed them that they had not been birthed by a god, but spewed from petri dishes full of recombinant DNA.
When all else is scraped away, yes, that is fundamentally what happened. They tried to live among us here, but could not. Nor could they come to terms with the truth of their existence.
What could the dissidents possibly get out of working with the Akaku?
An Aten more to their liking. One that is closer to the standard established by the original Akhenaten over 3,000 years ago. A revival of the old, old Egyptian ways.
That's ridiculous. No one really has a solid idea of what the old, old Egyptian ways actually were. Even before the nuke cost, the secrets of that civilization hadn't been fully revealed. Not even the exact method by which the pyramids were built was known.
Nevertheless, it is what they believe, and I must deal with it.
Nefron's eyes narrowed, and she fixed her crimson gaze first on Lakesh, then on Erica Van Sloan.
And unfortunately, you must deal with it too.
Mavati ran her hands through her hair, smoothing it with short, agitated motions.
Our entire way of life is about to change. Your arrival seemed to be the final push that they needed to mount an all-out attack.
Let me guess. You want us to help you hunt down whoever started this, don't you?
The Queen tilted her head once.
Yes. If you will help my people in this task, I will give you the equipment and data you need for the hybrid. We will be open to trade with you and the others whom you trust.
Your Highness, you can't possibly be serious. If you ally yourself with Sam, we can have troopers here within a day. They'll protect you and end any and all threats to your rule.
We will also trade with the Imperator. However, if in the future open hostilities break out between your two groups, we will remain neutral, no matter what.
Understandable. But I hope you understand that before we risk our asses to clean up a mess left over from your old man's reign, you show us proof you can deliver the goods.
Kane, how dare you question Her Highness?
What? Her Highness wants us to get involved in a local political conflict. I want an idea of what we'll get out of it.
You suggested that Her Majesty's word was not to be trusted.
Did I? My diplomacy fails me when blackmail is used as a negotiating tool, regardless of the circumstances. Let me remind everyone, we didn't ask to come here. The situation was set up so we had no choice. The Queen's word will be honored, I'm certain of that. Once we see what she's giving her word about.
Nefron at first appeared to be deeply offended. But then an abashed smile creased her lips.
You are a man of honor yourself, Kane. I won't presume to debate you on this matter.
Still smiling, Nephron stood and walked over to a low table by the far wall. Pulling open a small drawer, she withdrew a compact disc. She tossed the disc to Lakesh, who barely managed to catch it.
What is this?
It contains all the files that we recovered from the medical database of the Redoubt. It seems that the woman who created my father knew far more about selective mutation, the pantropic sciences, and gene therapy than most of her contemporaries. The healer DeFore brought with her a small computing machine you call a laptop. It should be able to access the files on the disk.
Lakesh studied the disk in his hand.
Thank you. I'm a little surprised that you would be so willing to part with this, since it more than likely contains not just the inner workings of Mission Invictus, but all of Over Project Excalibur's researchers.
I already have copied the information on it, and it's encrypted.
Would you care to give me some of the highlights of what I'm going to find here? Once it's decrypted, that is?
I would be happy to. Once you and your people agree to my terms...
None of us are interested in making more muties. So if the data on the disk is mainly about that, you'll have to offer something else.
There's no need to offer me anything else, Your Highness. I await your command.
You wouldn't fool a croupy dreg with that routine, Erica. So drop it before we all lose our appetites for the next year.
Who do you think you're talking to, Kane? I saved your life less than an hour ago, you turncoat thug.
I wondered how long it would take you to bring that up. You shot that poor deformed bastard so the Queen wouldn't suspect you or Sam of having a hand in the uprising. I just happened to be standing there. It could have been anybody.
Do you really think I had anything to do with the attempted coup?
That's not up to me to decide. Is it, Your Highness?
You have a lot of anger and resentment, Kane. In your mind, I can see concern about the hybrid, but more so about the baby she carries. You're not so much worried about its paternity, but what Sam wants to do with it. You feel he means it harm.
Bridget gestured angrily at Erica.
She was involved in abducting Quavel only a few months ago. All of us feel that Sam means the baby harm. Forcing us to work with Van Sloan is not the action of a friend. You want a simple solution to this problem. I'm afraid there isn't one this time around. Aten needs your help, and I am going to use the medical data and technology you need as leverage to get it. I'm sorry, but that's the way it's going to have to be.
Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown.
Kane stared at Nephron, the sudden anger leaving. Although he knew that she was genuinely sorry for using him and his friends in such a manner, it didn't take away the resentment.
What about the incarnates?
They will help you. My oracles are hunting for the citizens responsible for aiding and abetting the Akaku at this very moment. It is doubtful that those involved will be able to shield their thoughts for long. There will be three teams led by you, Grant, and Descartes.
You're purposely splitting us up.
By no means. You, Descartes, and Kane have the most experience in such activities, even more so than my incarnates.
So, once your oracles acquire some solid information, we'll be tracking down the perpetrators?
We, but not you. You're not going.
Why not? I have as much right to be with you on this hunt as Bridget.
I would prefer it if you would stay and talk with me, Dr. Singh. Once you have reviewed the data on the disk, we will have a great deal to discuss. I don't like this. She's probably keeping Sam up to date second by second.
If we want the equipment, we need to help Quavel, and we have no choice but to work alongside her.
You can't possibly trust her.
Why, Bridget, I don't know what would give you that idea. I trust her so much that one of my conditions for agreeing to this hunt is that Erica be on my team. But before I do that, I want some proof that Aten can deliver its end of the bargain.
Mavati straightened and stood up.
I will show you the proof. Come with me.